back together again. You and I chatting it up midweek Wednesday style, January 7th, 2026, right here on Connecticut Today, where I featured a discussion and some numbers on the latest figures regarding state of Connecticut worker pay. Hearst Connecticut Media senior columnist and editor Dan Hart dropped by with his weekly update, including reaction from Connecticut's congressional delegation on the recent capture of Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro and his wife. CBS News DC reporter Linda Kenyon updated us on White House reaction to Venezuela and some new Trump threats being made regarding Greenland. And a Sacred Heart University political science professor and scholar in residence, Dr. Gary Rose, joined us to comment on the latest developments in the 2026 Connecticut governor's race.
So a couple things here as we get started on this midweek Wednesday, the 7th of January, 2026. Two things here. And I'm going to put these out front. Number one, we're going to deal with, at least for the first couple of segments of the program here, because I want to get your thoughts on this. We are going to be dealing with a lot of numbers. I will try to make these numbers as easy to digest or digest. Porsche, Porsche, tomato, tomato. Digest or digest. I'll try to make them as understandable as possible. So my eyes, your eyes, the eyes of the guy over there or the gal over there don't glaze over. That's number one. A lot of numbers coming up here. So if you want to get out a, as they used to tell us in school, get out your scratch pad. You want me to scratch my what? No, your scratch pad. Number two, I don't blame any worker for taking money that is offered to them. Because in a situation, in a union situation, or wherever and whenever you have a negotiated settlement, the rank and file aren't in on the talks. The rank and file are not there. The union heads are, the men and women who negotiate for any union, and they say, hey, we like this, we don't like this, we know you're not going to give us this, but how about this, whatever. So, look, if somebody came to me, if Connoisseur Media came to me at the end of the show today and said, God, you know, we love you so much, here's X amount more, of course I'm going to say yes. Unless it had some stringent attachments with it, but that would never happen here with the folks I, good folks I work to work with here. So again, I don't look down on anybody that takes what is offered to them. But my question on some things is, when it comes to what we're going to talk about now, is essentially centered on how smart is this? Or is this a scenario where influence is undue politically and there is never an alternative to that? So what do I mean? Couple of analyses have popped up over the past few days. One with our friend Red Janky and one with our friend Mark Fitch here. From the Inside Investigator, and hopefully today or tomorrow we can talk to Mark. Mark, there is a, in fact, I'll put this story, I didn't do it yet, but I will effort to put this story on our Facebook page. So if you don't want to go poking around about it, but you want to find it, go to our Facebook page. The average state of Connecticut employee, all right? Now, we know average is average. It's not median, it's not the lowest, it's not the highest. An average is an average. You take an aggregate number of salary dollars, you divide it by how many people are in that specific bargaining unit or professions, and that's your average. That's math 101. The average state employee pay now tops in the state of Connecticut. The reason I bring this up is because you and I pay for it in some way, shape, or form. Like somebody in the Connoisseur building here, when he asked me what I was leading with today, and I told him, he said, well, who pays for that? You and I. The average state employee pay now, according to the latest numbers that have been released by a state actuarial report, is $94,000 a year. Now, if you make $94,000 a year, maybe you're not a state of Connecticut employee, maybe you're in the private sector, maybe you're a sole proprietor, 1099, whatever. No, but that's none of my business. None of my business. In the state of Connecticut, $94,000, unless you have a massive family and have huge expenses, if you're a single person or maybe married or cohabitating, maybe one or two kids, especially if your spouse or your significant other, the kids work, $94,000 ain't too bad. I mean, you know, it's not poverty wages by any means. And if you're living within your means, $94,000 should be okay, I would think. Of course, then again, that depends upon how you like to live your life, your spending habits, or whatever. But here's the interesting thing. It's $94,000. Now, what do you think the average pay for a state employee was when Governor Ned Lamont took over in 2018? What do you think it was? It's $94,000 now. But when Governor Ned Lamont took over in 2018, and now again, some raises had already been negotiated by former Governor Dana Malloy, but Governor Ned Lamont, and he has promised another raise to state employees. And again, we need good employees to run the state of Connecticut, all the departments. I'm not arguing that. What I am arguing is the perception in the eyes and minds of Connecticut taxpayers. When I say right now that the average state employee tops $94,000, actually $94,675, anybody who's, you know, paid by with a check or direct deposit from the state of Connecticut. State of Connecticut pay is you and I, it's taxpayers. It's even those people who are getting this money. We're all taxpayers in the state. So the average state employee pay right now, state employee pay stuff, got dry lips, $94,000. You know what it was in 2018? $69,000 and change. So let me ask you something. How many of you, and maybe there are some that are fortunate, how many of you were making $69,000 in 2018? And then 7 years later, because remember, they don't have their new deal yet. So in 7 years, you have seen your pay go up. What would that be? $25,000 in 7 years. Is that too much? Is that excessive? And again, when I say too much, and if you're a state employee, I'm not besmirching anything you do with your jobs. I get it. I understand it. But if I was somehow given X amount of a raise here at Connoisseur, and it was a large, large number, and it got out in the building here, or in any work environment, that, hey, did you hear how much Paul got? And there are people in the building who would be saying, well, really? And I got X and I got Y. Yes, it's the dynamic of the workplace. I get it. But again, we start with this. The average pay for Connecticut employees, state employees, and there are about 40, oh, four, hold on, let me scroll down here. There are 49,362 state employees with an average salary of $94,675, which means the state employee payroll is now a bit over $4.6 billion. When Ned Lamont took over in 2018, it was $3.4 billion. So we've gone up about $1.2 billion. Now, I know what you're going to say. Well, people deserve raises. Well, gosh darn it, yes, they do. But what is reasonable? Is an average salary jump when Ned Lamont took over of $69,000 in change to now $94,000 in change? Is that a little much? A 25% pay increase in what, 7 years? 7 years? You tell me. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. And we're not going to do this to hammer state employees. We're not. If I was a state employee and somebody said, hey, here's the contract deal, and you're going to get X amount per year for 6, 7, or 8 years, and if I like it, I'm going to say, well, yeah, hell, I'll vote yes on that sign. My question is the propriety of all this. Is this a good stewardship, if you will, of Connecticut taxpayer money? Yes, everybody looks to their, you know, the charity begins at home. I get that. I understand that. But again, during the Lamont years, we've gone from an average state employee salary of a bit over $69,700, and now we're at $94,675. Okay, that's good if you're on the receiving end. What if you're on the paying end? And that comes out of, well, your tax money and my tax money. You tell me. 203-333-9422-333-WICC. And again, on Facebook, facebook.com/voiceofct, the average Connecticut State employee's pay has risen from about $69,000 in 2018 to $94,000 in 2025. Is that too much? That's a 35% raise in 7 years. Is that too much or not? Okay, we're talking about, well, my tax money, your tax money. And listen, I'm not going to sit here and say, well, you know, we should pay state employees garbage. No. I'm not saying that at all. But as I've said earlier, whenever I tackle topics like this, when it comes to people's pay, and look, we all have a sense of how much we're worth, right? We talk to people in our business. Hey, she's only making that. Are you kidding me? Oh, he's making that. That's good. He deserves it. Boy, they should raise their pay. You know what I mean? We talk about, no matter what business we're in, we always talk about it. Wow, he took the job. Why would he go there? Well, they gave him $10,000 more than he thought. Okay, so again, sometimes pay, what you pay somebody, is a tool to be used by the prospective employer, and sometimes it's a tool to be used and to be parlayed by to and through with the prospective employee. But again, I'm not talking so much about people getting paid or not getting paid. It is the propriety of that amount of pay, and who does it cost in the end? Who pays that cost? And there is a new summary of numbers out by the state auditors, and it's been picked up in a few places, including at our friend Mark Fitch's site, the Connecticut Inside Investigator. And according to the figures there that, you know, are available to everybody, I'll put the link up for the story momentarily on the break here for news. The average state employee pay is up 35% in 7 years. Now, again, we all want people to have enough money and to eat and house themselves. That's not the issue. The issue is, what strain does this put this on the state of Connecticut when there are other things that the state has to pay for? So, again, in the first budget cycle or the first negotiation from the Malloy years to Governor Lamont's years, right? 2018, there were 49,153 state employees, and it's always varied around 46, 47, 48, 50,000, whatever. Used to be up around 50, 52,000. They got it down. Total payroll was about $3.4 billion, making it 69,700 average salary. But then we've gone from an average salary of 69,7 to 74,5 to 77,000 to 80 to 81,000 to 88,000 to 90,000 to $94,000 a year. Again, it's nice if you're getting it. But is this really necessary, or is this buying votes? Because remember, Connecticut's not bad, that all that big of a state. You've got 49,000 state employees, assuming probably 30 or 35,000 of them vote Democrat, and that means their husband or wife will vote in there. The kids will. The grandkids will. It adds up. Is a 35% increase for state employees, is it, I don't want to say is it warranted or not, judging on work, but is it fiscally responsible? That's what I'm asking today. Dave in Meriden kicks us off. Dave, how are you, sir?
Good, Paul. Hey, Happy New Year.
Thank you, sir. You too. Yep.
Hey, the one thing, now you mentioned $94,000.
Yeah.
Does that include the benefits? Because you've got to add another 30 to 40 grand a year just for their health benefits, et cetera.
I don't believe that. This is straight cash. Now, this is a very involved story. Yeah, but I believe it's straight cash. Yeah.
So you're adding another 30 to 40 grand a year. And a lot of these state employees, they're getting lifetime health benefits.
Sure.
And, you know, they've got... They got a real good deal there, but this is 7% or I'm sorry, 5% per year for 7 years justified. I mean, the cost of living is what, about half of that, 2.5%.
And apparently it's engineered, they say, to make sure it beat the COLA increase here. So listen, Dave, they've got good negotiators. Yep. My point is, at what control do the taxpayers of the state have on this?
Well, we have no control, as long as the Dems are in power.
Yeah.
Good luck.
All right, Dave. Hey, thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Yeah, there you go. All right, folks, you tell me. Am I off base here? You think I'm just a union hater, which I'm not. I'm all for public and private sector unions. I've had people tell me over the years, oh, you just hate unions. No. No. But is this just buying votes? You tell me. Traffic and weather together right here on WICC. Dan Haar stops by, Hearst Connecticut Media senior editor and columnist. Mr. Haar, good afternoon. Good to have you back. Happy New Year. How was all with you?
Great. It's 2026. Yeah. And here, it's an election year. We are in an election year.
I love this stuff, Dan. I don't know about you, but part of the reason I got into this, I love elections. I know people don't, some people, Dan, don't like them. I just love them. Don't you?
I vote in them as often as I can. If there isn't a good primary in the party in which I am registered, I change parties so that I can vote in the more interesting primary. So that'll give you an idea of how much I love elections, and I also love writing about them.
Excellent, excellent. Now, one gentleman that does face, I guess, a token challenge this year, maybe Jim Himes and Chris Murphy, who was not in the senatorial election cycle this year. They're okay, they're safe, Dan, but they've been kind of vocal, leading the opposition the Connecticut delegation has to what went on in Venezuela.
Yeah, I mean, I think all seven members of the delegation have spoken out to make the point, not that we would have preferred to see Maduro stay in power. Nobody is saying Nicolas Maduro was a good guy and gee whiz, why did you pick on him? And the Republicans who are making that claim are just making stuff up. But what they're saying is that as a violation of international law and of national U.S. law, in terms of an attack without consultation with Congress, mm-hmm. as that, this has consequences. And my long interview with Congressman Himes was in large part about those consequences.
Did he, and I know that he is sworn to secrecy because he's the ranking member on House Intel, and obviously, Dan Haar, he sees stuff that not only you and I don't see, but most members of Congress don't see. But did he allude to any of that? Is he completely unconvinced that this was the way to go?
When I spoke with him, he had not yet had the briefing.
Okay.
And I asked him in the conversation I had with him. I didn't include this in the interview because it's sort of, you know, it's what we're talking about now, but it's a little bit aside.
Yeah.
I said, are you open to the possibility that out of the briefing will come information that will change your mind about this having been an irresponsible raid?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, yes, absolutely. And I also said, well, can you tell me what was said? And I, as I said in the piece, Himes promised not to tell me what was said in the briefing, and he kept his word.
Well, I don't think they can, right?
Well, no, they can't. No. But what happens is, what typically happens is that Schumer and or Jeffries will come out, and for that matter, the Speaker and John Thune. In other words, the top leaders typically do come out and characterize what was said. They don't say this was said, but they said this is how I'm thinking. So Schumer came out of the meeting in person in the Capitol and told reporters, this is unacceptable. I am unconvinced. He didn't say any specifics that were said in the meeting. And I think that's an important distinction, because one of the reasons that the Secretary of the State of State, Rubio, in interviews on TV Sunday morning, he said he failed to include updates because he was afraid of leaks and because things were fast moving and we don't know what was happening. Turns out they had spent weeks building a house replicating the palace in Kentucky. And he lied. He lied and said it would have been bad enough if he didn't say anything about it. But he lied and said, no, we are not planning an operation. And that, I think, is what has got certainly Murphy and Himes upset. And that's what we're talking about. It's not just that they're upset about the operation. It's that they're upset about, once again, the administration lying to Congress.
So I wonder now, Dan, that fake Maduro house they built in Kentucky, that'd be a hell of a tourist attraction, don't you think? Can you imagine that?
I easily think that would make the house of the week at Hearst Connecticut Media without question. And I think we should suspend our practice of only including the houses on sale of interest in Connecticut. Yeah. I think we should go to, and I'm volunteering to be the reporter to go scope it out.
Yeah, who needs to go see one of the, who needs for you guys to run one of those $12 million Greenwich mansions? Yeah, head to Kentucky. All right.
We don't need those.
All right. Little banging of the legal heads here, right, Dan, between Pam Bondi, the Attorney General, William Tong, and maybe our Secretary of the State's office over what, the voter rolls here?
Well, she's saying that it is a state function and that we are taking the utmost efforts to assure fair and accurate election rolls. As we all know, Connecticut, like other states, has a big problem with maintaining accurate election rolls. And it has nothing, and I want to repeat that word, it has nothing, not anything to do with fraud, right? I want to be really clear here, and I know that I'm generally on this side of the equation anyway, politically, but the idea that there are people risking their residence, their freedom, and their way of life to cast a vote who are not legal voters, like the idea that that's happening in vast numbers is as our kids say, not a thing. It's just nonsense. It's just Republicans making stuff up. Now, was there vast fraud in Bridgeport that should have been adjudicated? Not only it is being adjudicated, that should have been addressed by the state House and Senate. Yes, the Republicans are 100% correct on that. But that does not mean that people are voting, that there are vast numbers of undocumented immigrants and others voting illegally. That's not happening. What's happening is that there are improper techniques that need to be done. That's not what the federal government is going after. That's not what this is about.
All right. And finally, interesting, Avello says, all right, forget the deportation flights. Now, Dan Haar, is this in any way connected to the protests in New Haven or what Avello wants to do to expand and get on the good side of people here? What's up with that?
The short answer is we don't know, and that's not what they're saying, but we suspect that that's true. Yeah. I want to just go back for 15 seconds and say that if the Trump administration and Pam Bondi were fair and even players in this, I would say they may or may not have a good legal case, but they're not. They have a history of going after people, and they have a history of going after blue states in ways that are pure politics, and this fits that description. So this is not some case floating around in space. That's not what's happening here. Anyway, let's get back to Avello.
Yeah.
They're saying they're getting out of those flights because of the price, the cost, and the difficulty makes it such that they're not making money at the flights. I personally like Andrew Levy, the CEO. I've talked with him. I just happen to believe that this is maybe not the full truth here. I think that the black eye that company, it's a good airline. They're doing a good job by customers. They're getting people from A to B at a low price.
Yeah.
Right. And I happen to think that the black eye they've been getting is probably worse than they're willing to say. That said, when you go to Tweed, it's awfully crowded there these days.
Yeah. So, I mean, it kind of looks like the old Pontius Pilate thing, Dan. Everybody kind of washes their hands, says, all right, this is over. Let's make, because they have all these big expansion plans for Tweed, right?
I wasn't prepared to make a Christian theological argument here. I said, no.
You like that?
So,
huh?
I'm not on board with the analogy, nor do I oppose it. I'm neutral.
You're
on
neutral.
Analogy.
You're like Norway or Sweden, but they want bigger things.
They want people to forget that the flights ever existed,
yeah,
and let's move on. Listen, Tweed is enough to chew. The big problem they have at Tweed right now, yeah, is that Avports is still fighting for the right to build that expansion,
yeah,
at Tweed.
Yeah.
And if that doesn't happen, I think I know that when you go to Tweed, listen, it's always a good thing to have a big crowd if you're a business.
Yeah.
Right. But on the other hand, it's not the experience that people had hoped for, nor should they expect, because if it's going to have the number of flights that it has, it needs to expand. That's the bigger problem. But no, I don't believe them that it had nothing to do with the backlash. That was a nasty backlash.
Yeah.
And rightful.
Dan Haar, Hearst Connecticut Media. Dan, have a happy rest of the week. Good weekend to you, and we'll chat with you next time, okay?
Thank you. I think we're coming up on the busy time of year.
Yeah, oh, it's gonna be great. Dan, thanks. Take care. Hearst Connecticut Media's Dan Haar. All right. Want to do our daily check-in with what's going on in D.C. Of course, our congressional delegation, two Senate members, five House members, still incensed mostly by what happened in Venezuela last weekend. We go to one of our go-to folks on this, CBS News reporter from D.C., Linda Kenyon, joining us. Linda, good afternoon. Great to have you as usual. What are we hearing anything more from the White House here, Linda, short-term, long-term, about what is the goal here?
Well, when it comes to Venezuela, as you are pretty much illustrating right, yeah, now, there are so many questions and so few answers. And so at today's White House press briefing, many of those questions were asked. For example,
mm-hmm,
what happens to the oil? what happens to who's governing Venezuela? And the answers have been essentially that the U.S. is going to be overseeing the interim government. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, the vice president, et cetera, are all very much involved in that. And when it comes to the oil, there's 30 to 50 million barrels of oil that the press secretary said are presently sitting in Venezuela,
yeah,
that there was a deal that was made with the interim government and the United States so that the U.S. would take those 30 to 50 million barrels of oil, take them to the U.S., and then sell them at a fair market price. The White House says that is to the benefit of both the Venezuelan and the American people. It will take a while to get through the various legal entanglements before those barrels of oil are actually released and put on the market. But for now, the president says that will be to the benefit of the prosperity and the security of both nations.
And Linda, finally, now we're hearing rumblings about Greenland, and there was a rumor that it would be all cash and no military here. Was any of that broached today or not that you saw?
Yeah, it certainly was, because much like Venezuela, there are a lot of questions about Greenland.
Yeah.
Greenland is a semi-autonomous nation from Denmark, and
yeah,
the Greenland officials and the Denmark officials are quite concerned about this, also NATO allies. So what's going to happen with this?
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
So what's going to happen with this is, the president is saying that he's been willing to take Greenland by force. He wants it for security reasons, to mm-hmm, protect against Russian and Chinese aggression. And he also is saying that he would, he's not taking military force off the table. He would prefer mm-hmm diplomacy, and that he might actually buy Greenland. All that's going to be discussed,
wow,
on Friday between Denmark, Greenland, and U.S. officials. So we'll,
yeah,
just have to stay tuned.
If we buy Greenland paper or plastic, I'm not sure what we use it. Linda, thank you. I'm going to now go beat up the gremlin that's in our automation system. We apologize for that. Linda, thank
no
you.
Problem.
Linda Kenyon, CBS News. Thank you, Linda. Appreciate it. Thanks.
Sure.
Bye-bye. There you go. All right. Of course, we are in the middle of just crazy times here nationally, maybe locally too. So when it gets nuts and it gets crazy, I go to my crazy file. Who do I call now? Dr. Gary Rose, Sacred Heart University Poli-Sci Professor, Scholar in Residence. Gary, good afternoon. How are you?
Hey, Paul. Good afternoon. Good to hear from you.
Hey, Gary, I've got a timeshare on Greenland. Are you interested at all?
I know. It could be next. I know. It seems like things are heading that way.
And there's stories coming out now, Gary, where, well, it won't be military, but we'll basically buy Greenland. I mean, the price will be, you know, it's like a Godfather movie. Make him an offer he can't refuse. I mean, yeah. And look, I guess the Trump thinking on this, Gary, is they're afraid what, China or Russia are going to land there first? I mean, this is wild.
Yeah, well, you know, up there in above Greenland, though, there are Russian ships. And so, I mean, there are some legitimate concerns about safety issues, you know. And but, you know, you talk about buying Greenland, but it'll be backed up, of course, with the potential of Trump, the Trump administration, actually taking Greenland, irrespective of what the Danes say about the offer.
Yeah.
So you've got the offer out there, but at the same time, I think the Danes are aware of the fact that there could actually be a military takeover of Greenland.
Yeah.
I think that could be coming.
Wow.
Anything's possible. Now,
yeah, and well, you know, we saw it a couple of days ago with Maduro, who, you know, Gary, is a bad guy. People of both sides have been saying this for years. The woman who led the opposition, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, has been saying this. Were you surprised Trump went in and did this like he did or not?
Not really. I mean, yes, I mean, a little surprised. But at the same time, you know, because of all the activity that preceded the apprehension, you know, we had the ships down there. We were seizing oil tankers. And of course, then we hit that docking area too, and it was pretty unclear how that happened. I think it was a drone. I'm not sure, but we took out a docking area where drugs were loaded, and so it seemed like we were getting closer and closer to some type of military action on the ground. And so, in that respect, I wasn't completely surprised. I was a little surprised over how quickly and so efficient it was. That was amazing. Of course, you know, the Delta Force is a very efficient unit of the military, but at the same time, boy, we got in there in and out in such lightning speed. It was really amazing to learn about that.
They must, I mean, Gary, with all the training those guys do, they must get bored. They must have been chomping at the bit to go do something. But yeah, it was amazing with the cyber attacks and they had built a facsimile of his compound. I mean, that stuff is just amazing.
Yeah, I know. And then we hit the grid too, knocked out all the power. Went in under the cover of darkness, and it was just a model of efficiency. But you know, the larger question is, was it legal?
Yeah.
You know, that's something obviously that we're going to be discussing in the days ahead. The Democrats claim that there was a violation of the War Powers Act. I'm not so certain of that, because it was really more of a law enforcement type of operation than the deployment of combat troops. But nevertheless, there are some questions about the legality of all this.
Let's get a bit closer to home now. Dr. Gary Rose, one of our favorites from Sacred Heart University. Gary, we have Aaron Stewart in the GOP governor's race. We have Ryan Fazio, and kind of circling there now, a part-time Connecticut resident, Betsy McCoy, a former lieutenant governor in New York. She is on, I believe, Newsmax now. A very smart woman. She knows health policy backwards and forwards. And from what I read and from what I hear, Gary, by my contacts, she's trying to figure out, going to the delegate-rich, kind of more conservative areas here, if she can at least qualify for a primary. And we've seen in the past, Gary, when the Republicans get to a primary, all bets are off. What are your thoughts on that?
All bets are off. You're right on that. And we've seen that in the past. But yeah, and it doesn't take much to force a primary now. You know, you can get either the 15% of the delegates at a convention, or you can petition your way on as a primary candidate, as Bob Stefanowski did the first time. Mm-hmm. And so, we could have a three-way primary, and it's kind of interesting because when you really think about it, you have Aaron Stewart, the more moderate type of Republican who's known for working across the aisle, you know, during her time as mayor. You have Ryan Fazio, who is really more of the Trump-like character. Then you've got, as you say, somebody circling. You have Betsy McCoy, you know, the former lieutenant governor of New York, and really more of she was a Democrat once and then became a Republican and really kind of a libertarian type. And so that's also another component of the Republican Party that's out there and it actually has some strength within the party. And so you could have a very dynamic three-way primary, and it would tell us a lot, I believe, about where the Republican Party is. And that's why I find primaries always interesting to study, because when the dust settles, it tells you, you know, pretty much what the ideological orientation is of the party at that particular time period.
And, you know, Gary, every press release you're seeing from the state Democratic Party, along with the Democratic leaders, you know, Bob Duff and Martin Looney and Matt Ritter and Jason Rojas, they are trying, and maybe they'll be successful in doing this, they're trying to attach Donald Trump to Ryan Fazio and to Aaron Stewart. Now, Aaron Stewart, if you remember in that kickoff video, she embraced it. She showed pictures of herself in the Oval Office with Trump. So do you think that'll be attack mode number one from state Democrats going in here?
It most certainly will. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, there are those who suggest that even the local elections were, you know, had to do with how people perceive Trump, and the Democrats had a big day with the local contests.
Yeah.
And so, sure, they're going to absolutely brand every one of these Republicans, whether it's Fazio or Stewart, whoever gets the nomination, or Betsy McCoy, as a Trump acolyte. And that is obviously, a very successful and effective way in which the Democrats can maintain control of the governorship to do that, because Donald Trump's approval ratings are very low these days. They're lower than they were during the last time that he ran. And so, in many ways, Trump will be on the ballot, even though he's not going to be a candidate, I mean, for governor, of course. But his name will be foremost among Democrats. They'll be mentioning that's a Trump statement, that's a Trump candidate, that's what Trump favors. And who knows if Trump's going to actually endorse Fazio if he gets the nomination. He might.
Yeah.
And if that does, then that's the death knell, quite frankly, because Connecticut, you know as well as I and everybody knows, Connecticut is not Trump country. It really isn't.
Yeah. And, you know, Gary, it's interesting. In fact, I wanted to end on this. You led me into it. Could be the death knell. But then again, if one of the candidates, either, let's say, Betsy McCoy gets in, or Ryan Fazio or Aaron Stewart, can they come out and say, well, all they want to do is talk about Trump. Here's how I will lower your electric bill. Because, you know, Gary, last time I checked, they don't bill people Eversource or UI or Avangrid. Doesn't matter whether you're a D or an R. You still got to pay that electric bill. And I'm wondering if that's one of the issues you would recommend them using, like, to cut through on this. You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. And we know that Fazio is known for, you know, the whole electric issue here in Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And that really is, in many ways, one of his meal ticket to the nomination. But nevertheless, no matter what issues these candidates articulate and bring to the voters, your previous point about the Democrats pasting them in many ways with Trump is really what they're going to do to try to, you know, move the electorate in their own direction, which is very effective. So it's going to be difficult for them to get away from Trump, even though they may not even mention him in the campaign. No matter what, they're going to be in many ways perceived as, you know, supporters of Trump, acolytes of Trump, and MAGA type of candidates. And that's what the Democratic playbook is. Now, And it's very effective in certain states, including our own.
Sure. Yeah.
So it's going to be tough to get away from that.
Yeah.
And you know, if Trump endorses them, then of course there's no way out of it. But you know what I mean? But
can you imagine if he comes here and he does a campaign appearance? Oh my God.
Oh, I know. Well, you know, you got the Leora Levy experience there. We know what happened there.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if they're going to try to keep him at arm's length. Maybe they should. But it might be a little difficult. It really might be.
All right, yeah. Gary. Hey, thanks. And I'll let you know what happens. I have a meeting tomorrow with a timeshare guy from Greenland. So I'll let you know what the maintenance fees are in Greenland.
It's a good retirement place.
<Yeah. laughs> I hear the views are really nice. Dr. Gary Rose, scholar in residence, Sacred Heart University. Gary, thanks. Be good. We'll chat down the road. Thank you, sir.
Okay, Paul.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. How about that? Can you imagine that?